right now, I want to chat about, you know, you all heard the story a couple of years ago, astronaut Mark Kelly. Mark Kelly remained on Earth. His brother, Scott Kelly, they're identical twins, went up into space for a whole year, went to the space station for an entire year for kind of a landmark study on how space affects us. We all know that there have been some issues with people who spend too much time in space because of gravity and oxygen, all sorts of things like that. So they decided, well, we've got these two identical sets of genes. Let's put one up in space and keep the other one down and see what happens. And the stories that came out recently were that his genes were affected and didn't all go back to normal. So we wanted to find out a little bit more about that. And so just found an amazing researcher. Her name is Nancy Siegel. She's the author of Twin Myth Conceptions, False Beliefs, Fables, and Facts About Twins and Accidental Brothers, the story of twins exchanged at birth and the power of nature and nurture. Nancy is she is a professor of psychology at California State University Fullerton and director of the Twin Study Center, which she founded back in 1991. Good morning, Nancy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone with us. We appreciate it. When NASA announced that they were going to send a twin up in space for a whole year and then study what happens, you had to be pretty geeked out about that and excited, weren't you?
I was so excited because it's a very simple and very elegant experiment. As you said in the introduction, you've got identical twins with the same genes. You keep one on Earth, you send one up in space, and then you can see the effects because you've got this perfect control down here on Earth.
Yeah.
It'll tell us so much about the effects of space travel on psychological traits, behavioral traits, and on physical traits.
Well, the headlines that first came out when he came back or recently were that his genes were altered and have not gone back to normal. And people started being like, wait a minute, if his genes changed, he wouldn't look the same. It wouldn't just be that. So explain to me what exactly we're saying when his genes are not acting in the same way.
Well, it wasn't the genes themselves that changed. Rather, the way they get expressed had changed. It looked like there'd been some premature aging based on the change of certain structures. But my understanding is that some of it has gone back. Now, some other things had changed, some of his visual abilities, as well as bone density. Bone density is a very, very sensitive type of trait in space travel.
Bone density, and why is that? Is it so much of this due to the lack of gravity, or what are the factors that are harming people when they spend so much time in space?
It's probably a multiplicity of factors. It's probably the gravity issues. It's probably just a totally different lifestyle environment, probably many, many things. And probably there are some people who are more sensitive to it than others. But the basic point is that you've got this wonderful control down here on Earth for the purposes of comparison.
Yeah. So, and you know, what's interesting to me is when they talk about issues with gravity, and you think about, okay, what would they do about that? Because if they just, you know, did weighted boots or whatever within this so that somebody stood or didn't float the whole time, the organs in their body would still be floating even if they were attached to something. So that wouldn't really answer the problems, would it?
No, it probably wouldn't, and they're just going to have to be more creative in terms of finding ways to protect individuals who do go to space. But I should point out to you that it wasn't really NASA who decided to do this, although they certainly agree to it. It was the twins themselves who came up with the idea.
Was it really? They said, hey,
yes.
What? Oh, that's pretty cool.
Huh. Well, twins are amazingly bright when it comes to scientific research. I just love working with twins because they're very interested in themselves as scientific participants, just as unusual people. And so they're willing to take part in research, and they think creatively about who they are and how they got that way.
Nancy, I'm looking at your biography, and you've done a ton of work on twins. What got you so interested in studying twins?
Well, actually, it's because I'm a twin myself.
Okay.
I'm a fraternal twin, and I have a sister who really looks and behaves nothing like me. And so as a small child, I was so fascinated by this because we grew up with the same parents in the same home, went to the same school and summer camps, had many friends in common, and we still turned out to be so different. And I would see these twins in school who were exactly the same in their appearance, and they seemed to get along so well and do the same thing. So it really drove my curiosity. So then when I got to college, and I was always interested in people, psychology was a natural field for me to enter. And we hit the nature-nurture questions. In particular, I was asked to write a paper about personal adjustment. So I decided to pick a topic that I know is of great interest to twins and to their parents, and that's the question of whether or not you separate twins upon school entry. Do you put them into separate classes? And that was an issue my parents struggled with as well. Mm. And I found that I enjoyed reading this literature so much in a way that I hadn't enjoyed anything. And so I just knew right then and there that this was going to be my calling. And I have to tell you that it's been more exciting and more interesting and more informative as I go through it. I find new topics to study, wonderful people to work with. It's just been a complete joy.
Oh, interesting. And now when we hear about twins and, like, you know, they feel pain when another one feels pain, or you'll hear these amazing stories about this connection between twins, is a lot of that, do you find that to really be true? And you mentioned that you're a fraternal twin. Is there a huge difference between fraternal twins and identical twins and their relationships?
You posed a lot of questions here, so I'll start with the second one. There is a huge difference between identical and fraternal twins. Identical twins share all their genes in common, having split from a single fertilized egg within the first 2 weeks after conception. And fraternal twins result when a woman releases two eggs at the same time, and they're separately fertilized by two separate sperm. So these twins share half their genes on average, which is exactly the same as ordinary siblings. Now, your question about ESP or telepathic communication, there is really no evidence for this whatsoever. In fact, in my book, Twin Mythconceptions, this is one of the mythconceptions I address. And we do see a kind of interesting phenomenon within identical twins, more than fraternals. I think it's because they're socially closer to one another. But that makes sense because they share so many characteristics in common, which do have a partial genetic basis. The way they interpret the world, their information processing strategies, their personalities, things of that sort. So they tend to be closer on average than fraternal twins. Now, in my other book that's coming out in 2 weeks, Accidental Brothers, this tells the extraordinary story of two sets of twins from Colombia, South America, who were accidentally switched at birth. So you had two sets of unrelated brothers growing up 150 miles apart, thinking they were fraternal twins, and none of those pairs ever had an inkling that there was an identical twin out there. And if there was such a thing as telepathic communication, then that should have been the case. I worked for many years on the Minnesota study of twins raised apart at the University of Minnesota. I must have studied close to 100 of these amazing sets, and I don't think I can even name one pair that experienced that kind of connection.
Mm, fascinating. So that's interesting because there's really two different ways then to sort of study twins, I guess. The identical twins who spend every moment together versus the fraternal twins who spend every moment together. The fraternal twins that grow up together and experience all the same things and you see the differences. They're just like a pair of a pair of brothers who could have been born years apart, but they actually happen to be born the same time, so they go through all these things together, versus the identical who not only go through everything together in that same way, but also share some genes, so you would think would react and do certain things in certain ways. What? Tell me a little bit more about the genes and how that affects an identical twin. Like, what type of things would twins be more likely to experience in the same way or express in the same way because of their identicality of their genes?
Okay. Well, I must tell you that at this point, there are just reams and reams of studies showing that virtually every human trait has a genetic component at some level. This is not saying that everything is completely genetically influenced, but rather that the various behaviors and physical traits that we have are influenced to some degree by genetic effects. And this varies, you know, somewhat from trait to trait. But we do find a genetic influence on general intelligence, on special abilities like verbal processing, perceptual speed, spatial orientation. We find genetic influences on personality, on how aggressive you might be, on how sociable you might be. We find genetic influences on a host of diseases, from multiple sclerosis to various types of cancers and diabetes. But I must point out that identical twins are not exactly the same in any way, which means the environment is clearly playing a role. In fact, if you take some of the mental disorders like schizophrenia, only about 40% of identical twins who have an affected twin brother or sister do themselves show the condition. So this is, again, interesting. It's kind of like a natural twin control, kind of like the Kelly brothers, although one of them was purposely sent into space. But if you have identical twins where one has a disease and one doesn't, this is a way of looking to see what activates the genetic predisposition in one but keeps it silent in the other. So twins themselves are just walking natural experiments. They really, really are. But I also want to point out that there is overlap among the identicals and fraternals. Some identicals are more alike than others. Some fraternal twins are more alike than others, just like ordinary siblings can be. And some fraternal twins are as socially close as identicals, and some identical twins aren't that close at all. But what's interesting and important is the general trend. And with the general trend, it's that identicals are very similar in most ways and very close, fraternal twins less so.
That's interesting, because the very close, I would imagine, that really just depends on how they grew up and who they became more than their genetic makeup, I would think, right?
Well, it's multiple causation. You know, part of it depends on their personality. If you're born very aggressive or very distant or very hostile, you know, you're probably not going to develop a really close relationship with your twin.
Can you be born very distant, aggressive, or hostile?
Well. What I mean is that the predisposition to develop these kinds of traits, you know, obviously, whoever we become is a combination of our genes being expressed in an environment. And so maybe you have the predisposition to be a certain way, but something about the environment will mitigate it. You see what I'm saying?
So we do have, I don't know that. We do have predispositions that we're born with to maybe be more aggressive, be more athletic, be more, I imagine athletic because that's genetic makeup and stuff, but be angrier, things like that. There is a predisposition that could be activated for that?
Yeah, there are predispositions that may or may not be expressed depending upon the environment. And, you know, parents right away who have fraternal twins see differences between their children. There might be a more active twin. There might be a more alert twin. I really believe that parents of fraternal twins are probably the sharpest observers of behavior that we have. We all have predispositions. Individual differences are all around us. Nobody is exactly the same. Even identical twins are not exactly the same, despite their similar genes. And why? Because of a lot of prenatal and postnatal factors that may activate certain genes. I mean, think about this. We know that an allergy to penicillin is genetically influenced. And if you're somebody who has this predisposition, but you never get a penicillin shot, you're never going to show the reaction. But if you do get that shot, then you will show it. So that's, I think, a good way of thinking about certain types of behaviors.
Well, and I wonder if, like you mentioned, that parents seem to know right away their kids are certain ways. And I wonder how much of what we think they are, they become, because that's how we treat them. So, for example, Nancy, we actually have fraternal triplets in our house that are 12 years old. Yes, two boys and a girl. And they all have their very distinct personalities. But I wonder how much we reinforce those personalities by telling them all the time or reacting to them because of how we feel they are.
Well, you see, you've hit the nail on the head, because parents do react to children based on their children's behaviors. But the important point is that parents don't create these. Now, if you wanted to create your children a certain way, they should all be the same. But you've just told me that your 12-year-old kids, same age, growing up in the same home with the same parents, and they probably had a lot of similar experiences, are quite different. And it's because each of those children came into the world with a different set of predispositions. You know, we tend to think of the home environment as being the same for all children, but it really isn't. There could be one child who really loves the sports equipment that's available, or another child that shuns the sports equipment but goes to the computers. So children will gravitate towards certain types of elements in their home based upon who they are. Parents can reinforce, of course. Parents can downplay certain things. Parents have important roles in finding out what children are good at, what children like to do, and nurturing these opportunities as much as possible. But parents do not create them. Parents react to children. And, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, parents treat their kids differently. Well, of course they do. And in my mind, that's their treatment. If you try to treat your children exactly the same, that would probably shortchange one or two of them.
I have to ask you a question now, because I've just started watching at home this show called Mindhunter. Have you heard of this on Netflix?
I haven't.
Okay, so it's on Netflix, and I don't know how much it's based in fact. I think it's supposed to be, but it's about the FBI in like the 70s and starting to look at the psychology of why crimes are committed certain ways. They started having more thrill killings, Son of Sam, Manson stuff, and these two guys within the FBI wanted to start looking at, you know, the FBI had just been figure out who did it, catch them, put them in jail. And they were trying to come up with, well, if they commit a crime in a certain way, what were they thinking? Why were they thinking? And if we could start figuring that out, maybe we can prevent some of these or catch them quicker, things like that. And so they were talking about how the thinking back at the time was sometimes just there's bad people in the world. They were born that way. Is there, when we talk about predispositions, are kids, some kids predisposed to have a higher likelihood of becoming criminals?
Predispositions are not absolutes. Genes work in probabilistic ways, not in deterministic ways. There may be some children who are at higher risk for certain types of behaviors, which can sometimes be overridden by certain types of very sensitive parenting, certain types of environmental exposures. But we do have different predispositions that we come into the world with, and in conjunction with our environment, they may or may not be expressed. They may or may not be expressed to the same degree. A lot of it just depends. But children do come into the world with certain predispositions. And as I said, you're in a unique position to see this, being the father of fraternal triplets, as are other parents who have fraternal twins or children very near in age. You know, I often say that parents of one child are environmentalists because they do certain things and maybe they see what they think is a certain response. But parents of more than one child tend to be the quote-unquote geneticists because they can see that what they do for one child may not work with the other. One of the best examples I can give you on this point is a family I studied in one of my books called Indivisible by Two, where the mom naturally conceived quadruplets, but they were born as two sets of identical twins because she obviously conceived fraternals and each one of those fertilized eggs divided. And she said that there were just enormous differences between the two identical pairs. Between the two identical pairs, but within the identical pairs, there were a lot of similarities. So again, you know, you can see that right from birth, children do have different sorts of behaviors.
I'm sorry I'm getting so hung up on the predispositions, but it's fascinating to me. And when we talk about that in genetic terms, are those being identified, those predispositions? I mean, 20 years from now, will my kids be having kids and a geneticist tell them, well, here's the genes that are likely, that the predispositions are likely to have? Like, are we eventually going to say, oh, these couples shouldn't have kids together because the predispositions of these things might be dangerous?
First of all, when you talk about predispositions for complex behaviors like criminality, aggression, things of that, those are the kinds of behaviors that are influenced by many, many genes.
Sure.
And even though researchers now are finding certain genes linked to certain complex behaviors, I mean, even height and weight, very complex behaviors, these genes, each individual gene that might be linked to these behaviors, accounts for a very, very tiny portion of the influence. So I think that we are a very, very, very far distance from actually specifying should person A marry couple B or marry person B, etc. I think that we're a very far distance from that. And, you know, I think that most couples are going to want to have children the old-fashioned way. The element of surprise about what you get, I think, you know, really makes parenting an exciting proposition. And I think that, you know, when you start to tinker with genes, I mean, you don't know exactly what, you know, is going to come out. Now, when we think about single gene traits, such as diseases, Tay-Sachs disease, that is due to having two recessive genes. And so if you've got a parent that carries one and a parent that carries the other, the chance that the child will be affected is 25%. So couples like that are often advised to undergo some kind of genetic counseling, maybe prenatal diagnosis to see if, in fact, the child is affected. Because Tay-Sachs is a very a heartbreaking disease. The child is born normally and remains that way for a number of months until just degenerates and, and will die by age three. It's a very heartbreaking condition. But with genetic counseling, you know, we can oversee that kind of thing and prevent it. But that's a far cry from talking about a complex behavior, as I said, such as criminality or personality or certain sorts of mental abilities.
It is. I just worry, you know, the way our world is headed with technology and everything else, that people would start. What was the, there was a Tom Cruise movie, right? A Minority Report, where they were, wasn't that where they were predicting, you know, arresting criminals before they committed crimes and things like that. And I know.
Yeah, well, I didn't see the movie. And I think that when some of the scientific evidence gets out, I think that there is a lot of room for misinterpretation, misapplication.
Sure.
But that's not a reason not to do it. I think that what's important is for scientists to very clearly explain what these things can do, what they can't do. That's what's important, scientific understanding. There are a lot of benefits to things. Look, when in vitro fertilization was introduced in England in 1978 and in this country in 1981, people threw their hands up and said that's the end of family life as we know it. But you know what? It's not. And what it's done instead is it has brought a lot of joy and a lot of pleasure to so many countless couples who would otherwise have been infertile.
Yeah.
So now there's also, you know, there's room for you know, distortion of these things. But as long as you are aware of things and information is out there, that's the most important thing. Public understanding.
Nancy Siegel is the author of the book that's about to come out, Accidental Brothers, The Story of Twins Exchanged at Birth and the Power of Nature and Nurture. We're out of time tonight, but I'd love to have you back down the road to talk about that in depth a little more, because I'm sure that's just a fascinating story.
It is, and I'd love to come back. You just send me an invitation.
That sounds good. Nancy, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us.
Not a problem. My pleasure.
All right. Have a great morning. Again, Accidental Brothers, The Story of Twins Exchanged at Birth and the Power of Nature and Nurture. One of the older books from last year, Twin Myth Conceptions, False Beliefs, Fables, and Facts About Twins.